This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I want to be a billionaire so fucking bad. Buy all of the things I never had.
If you win the lottery. Yeah, there's some big prizes out there. Remember, if you don't play, you can't win. Oprah.
Oh, every time I close my eyes, I see my name in shiny light.
That could be you.
Yeah, a different city every night. Oh, I swear, the world better prepare for when I'm a billionaire.
That was with a B, not an M, okay? That's big money. All right, you're going to hear right now an interview that Colonel Kevin Norton did with a veteran of the 4th Marine Regiment, and his name is Warren Jorgensen. So sit back, relax, enjoy this as we continue on a Thursday, All Marine Radio. Love these kind of interviews with Marines who fought and want to share their story.
Just want to start with... today is April 10th, 2017, and I'm in Bennington, Nebraska, a little town outside of Omaha, Nebraska. And my name is Colonel Kevin Norton. I have the privilege to be the CO of the 4th Marine Regiment, and I'm here with Sergeant Warren Jorgensen, who served in the 4th Marines in China and then later on Corregidor, and that's why I came out here to see you. When were you born?
1921.
What day?
March 15th.
And how old are you now?
96.
Where did you grow up?
The little railroad village called Bertram, the west east of Cedar Rapids in Iowa.
And so what was life growing up in the 1920s and 1930s in the United States?
In that little town, I was pretty... restricted to that because we didn't even have a car until 1935, and so there was only maybe 10 other kids in town to play with. So, to be honest with you, Colonel, I think I was led sort of a sheltered life. Anyway,
small town, middle America.
The Marine Corps was the best thing that ever happened to me.
So what was there a recruiting station somewhere in Cedar Rapids that you went down to?
Yes, I answered an ad in the Cedar Rapids paper. It says, too few good Marines noted for Asiatic Station. And I thought, gee, that sounds romantic.
And where did you, once you signed up, tell me about how you left Iowa and where did you head next? Boot camp?
Yeah. To enlist, I had to go. They did have an office, small office in the post office in Cedar Rapids. But I had to go to Des Moines, where the major was, for signing in. And on that particular day, three of us, two from Nebraska and myself from Iowa, took the oath. And they put us on a train at 4 o'clock that evening and sent us to San Diego. And from there, it was a whole new world.
What was recruit training like in San Diego? Can you describe that for us?
I can tell you the first morning, it was just, I wondered why I made that mistake. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, it was, boot camp was a piece of cake to what the guys go through now. We did fire the range, and we did go to Pendleton down there to do that. And we used most of the weapons except hand grenades. And the hardest part of it all was adjusting to the language. I was sheltered. I never heard bad words like that. My God. So you quickly had to adapt and... we did have differences between the guys from the south and the guys from the north. There were only 25,000 Marines in there when I enlisted.
What was the pay like back then?
$21 a month.
$21 a month.
And private. And the PFC, I believe, was 30. And then they upped it sometime in, I guess, 40 to $30 for the PFC and 36, 30 for the private and 36 for the PFC.
When you went to the rifle range to qualify, was it a 03 Springfield?
Yes.
How'd you like that rifle?
Why, it is. After you got used to the sear, you know, getting past that little thing on the sear, I liked it.
Was it accurate?
Oh, yeah.
You also said you fired a Tommy
gun, close to Colt pistol. We went in the tear gas chamber.
How long was
it? We were 90 day wonders.
90 days.
Yeah.
And when you came out of recruit training, how did you know, was everybody an infantry guy? How did you know what job or specialty you were going to get given?
Didn't know. First thing to know, we got this left recruit depot. They said, you're going to get on the Antares the next morning in the San Diego Harbor, the old transport. And we got on the Antares and Chip painted all the way to Frisco. And
well, they had you guys chipping the paint on the trip.
Steel back. And it was on the hill going under the Golden Gate Bridge. Because I was here in a small town. Oh, I am. Going under that bridge.
Had you ever been on a ship before that?
No. Well, on the river.
Tell me, what was it like to be stationed in China? What was your job there?
Oh, boy, that was good doing. Arrived there in the end of April in 1940, and we went out on the Henderson Navy transport, and it dropped you in the wing room, and you go into the beach to the Bund on the tender. And the Bund in China was just spectacular. We were on a bus, one of those canopy buses, and I by myself was let out of A Company, and the other guys then were distributed around the regiment. We had three different areas, the 1st Battalion, 2nd Battalion, well, regimental headquarters, and older transport.
And can you describe what the job was there? What was the duty?
Oh, strictly infantry. The term was we carried the colors. We flew the flag, and we, at every opportunity, the 4th Marines and 4th Marines became very ingrained into the community. As you very well know, Fourth Marines became very important to Shanghai.
How many other foreign countries' militaries were there? Do you remember?
Yes. There was a big race course there and the big stadium. And underneath the stadium was a regiment of English Seaforths. And a regiment of Scotch Highlanders. And they all left, you know, trouble coming down the road. And they went, they went to Singapore a year before we ever left.
I had heard that for the Marine Corps, that time era, particularly in the 1930s, and when the Great Depression was happening back here in the United States, that if you were in the Marine Corps, that was good duty because the money went a long way over there.
Yeah, I understand that it was the favorite post for duty post in the Marine Corps.
So did they pay you in American dollars over there?
Yes.
And then you could take those American dollars and exchange them?
At a pay table. First sergeant said at the pay table. And dispense the money, and at the other part of the table was a Chinese money merchant from downtown, And the guys who wanted to convert $10 or $20 of gold would go over there to him, and he would convert to Chinese currency. And when I got the currency rate, it got as high as 22, 23 to 1. First night, I took a liberty, it cost me $1. It was and wonderful facilities, great restaurants, and a lot of entertainment. It was just a very good day.
So we were on guard duty there. The mission was to show the flag and be part of the international settlement with all these other countries. And then,
let's see, if I may.
Yes, sir.
It was just a pleasure being there. But what was really exciting was we did a formation amongst first of one battalion. So we did a battalion review 1 month, and then 3 months. We did a regimental review. And to get to this field where we did the review, you were in dress formation. That's freaked me out. There was nothing more thrilling to see 500 string of 500 Marines in unison parading along the street and trying to fly in the flag. And the people would stand there and gawk, and they knew the kids were enjoying it. And that was the highlight. I'll never forget the Sousa marches.
Yeah. That is good stuff. With the regimental and battalion colors flying and the Marines in formation.
Yeah, we would even let the Chinese in the stands if they wanted to watch it.
That must have been.
Now, I don't know if it sounds like he's laughing, but he's not. He got very emotional talking about that, there's a picture of the Marines in their uniforms in formation as part of the parade. So it's interesting. Interesting stuff. You know, these tales of what it was to be a China Marine, you don't hear too many, you know, there's not too many accounts like this. But you've heard stories in the Marine Corps, how they lived, and how much the Marines enjoyed life in China as part of the international delegation. Most countries had them. And living in an exotic part of the world. So you're listening to Warren Jorgensen interviewed by the at that time the commanding officer of the 4th Marine Regiment, Colonel Norton.
That's impressive.
It was.
And you had the band. I mean, that helps
too.
That's
true. I didn't acknowledge that. That's right.
Take us to the last days of China before was the conditions there in China heating up to where you guys knew it's time to get out of here?
Yeah, yes, sir. All the regiment officers who were living there had lived downtown, and they now had to come in and live on post on the big in the house. And we lived in billets instead of barracks. And so we had four company officers come back and billet in our billet. And then things really started to change. We did exercises every day. We studied some history, and they really bore down on us. We knew something was going to happen.
Some of your NCOs or officers or maybe company commander, can you tell me anything about the officers and how was their leadership there in China?
Excellent. The NCO was always a backbone.
Any other thoughts on China that you might remember? How was the colonel? Who was your battalion commander?
We had a supreme commander, Lieutenant Colonel Beecher.
I saw his picture in some of the. He's in, yeah. So I'll find him in here. But yeah, Lieutenant Colonel Beecher How was he?
Oh, boy, a gentleman with a scar, and you name it. He was a hard-boiled Marine at that. He was dedicated. By the way, I'll mention that I had one of those other guard posts one night at the galley. And officers in those days would ride in touring cars and high wheels and open, you know, and isinglass windows. And some of them would even have a dog. And this particular night, one of the guys came into my room on duty, and his dog jumped out. And Su Xiao was one in the compound with me, this dog. And I was guilty of sinking Su Xiao on that dog. And as a result of it, I went out. I did have to chat him office hours.
So you had to go see Lieutenant Colonel Beecher?
Yes.
Because you sicked your dog on another dog.
Yeah.
How long did he say at office hours?
Well, he just scolded me and let me off easy. Just don't behave like that again.
That's a great story.
Yeah, and then during the prisoner area, he became a hero on the hell shifts. He made it all the way through 3 hell shifts. Outstanding man.
In November of 1941, right before Pearl Harbor gets bombed, we leave China and we go to the Philippines. Tell us about that. What ship were you on? What was that like?
Yeah.
China was always visited by the president liners. Apparently the government leased one of these, or two of the president liners, and they brought in President Madison and the President Harrison. And the 2nd Battalion left the first day on the Madison. Turns out we got the best bull. He was bigger and faster. And we got the Harrison. And we were going to the... you're going into the sumptuous hotel now. You don't know he's a president.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. The officers all had the cannons. NCOs even had cannons. And so we just left on cots.
You guys marched down to the pier.
Yeah, that was the day. Yeah. So that's right. The first battalion left whatever day ahead of us. And then we were to leave the next day. And we fell out in the morning. Full dress. Fuel pack. Big hard cartridge belt. Whole ball of wax. And we stood there in ranks waiting for the command to go. And was another emotional morning. When you first come into Shanghai, they encouraged the men, if they were to have an affair with a lady, don't marry. Just live in sin. And because if the phone rings and you're going to go, you go.
And she's not coming.
And here we are. Get ready to go. It was no outbound trip to come back. We're going out, and we're going, and here's those women with the kids.
All standing there.
Yeah. And the NCO could not be friends and go and talk to them. He had to look away to talk to them.
That's heart-rendering. Because that's their kids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then on the march down through town, there was big crowds lighting Bubbling Well Road, and we were just people shouting names and waving flags, and total the crowd was just lined up. And we had to pass the Port Marine Club, which was tough to do because we were all so imbued with that history. And then on the Bubbard Mall, finally went by. There was a restaurant there owned by an American down near the Bug, and he had picked up an orchestra, and they were out there playing American jazz for us. And they followed us down to the Bug, and this was crowds after crowds. They knew the end had come. The next step that's going to happen is the Japanese are now our officers, our bosses.
Yeah.
And they sure to see the Americans go.
It's interesting. For those of you familiar with American history, Bataan, the Marines there are part of the Bataan Death March, along with the United States Army soldiers and along with a lot of Filipinos. And so unless something intervenes, Mr. Jorgensen is headed in that direction. And you can hear the emotion in his voice as he talks about the life in China for them and leaving it and what fate has in store for all the Marines.
Got on the President Harrison, and we marched down to the pier.
On the Harrison, the third night out, I'm a runner now, I'm not up in this room, and I woke up maybe around 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were laid to. Nothing happened. They couldn't even feel the screws. And so I put on my trousers and went out on deck, and boy, there were lights all over the place. We were in the Formosa Straits, and I'll always think that was a piece of the flotilla that was going to Pearl Harbor.
Probably was.
It was just a piece of it. And then the engines finally started again, and we moved on. And
so you all shut the engines off to just lay quiet?
Yes. I imagine that was...
Because if those were Japanese warships, that wouldn't have went too well.
Absolutely. and so in the morning, we were in open water, being joined by an American submarine. They took us all the way in to a long time.
So tell me about that. What was the mission when the 4th Marines first got into Olongapo? You didn't immediately go to Corregidor.
I understand there was a lot of haggling going on between Admiral Hart and the MacArthur.
MacArthur wanted the Marines under him.
Yes. And at the same time, he had the 31st American Infantry and three divisions of well-trained Filipino scouts, and he just as soon had no part of us. And Hart had been pressuring him to get us to come to Corregidor. Why? Because of that naval tunnel on there. So he didn't want to lose Corregidor at any expense. And just a little sidelight about that naval tunnel. I had my good buddy, Sam, out that age from Chicago. Sammy had the duty on the door at the naval tunnel. He had the pleasure of telling MacArthur, "Sorry, you ain't going in." He did.
MacArthur wanted to go inside the tunnel?
Yes. And they were so strict about that tunnel. So you had to be passed to get into it. It was high security. That's where they cracked the code that helped to save the Coral Sea.
Well, and this tunnel, is this Malinta Tunnel we're talking about?
Yes. And the Naval Tunnel is part of the Malinta Tunnel.
Offshoot of it.
Yes.
Early on, so you guys landed in and around, what, early, mid-November? 41.
Early December. Really.
Early December, 41.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Pearl Harbor happened.
Oh, we had only been there for several days. Yeah. And we went to the South Line one morning, and a guy comes through on a sidecar and says, Wahoo has been bombed. And we frankly didn't take that too seriously, because we had four gunboats. We went the Yangtze River with us, and one was the Wahoo. So we thought maybe they had hit that gunboat.
You thought they hit that ship? You bring up a good point, and that's the point of back then and just the media, and you oftentimes you don't know what's going on.
Oh, you're right.
Nowadays, with the internet, people kind of know more things that's going on. But back then,
no Twitter.
What's the scoop back then? What's going on? And so you guys left. You guys had some mission down there.
MacArthur didn't. Well, I can't really say it. We're not going to the front. So on November 29th, they decided we would go on to December 29th. We'd go on to Kurganov.
And so, little known fact, I believe, and you'll tell me, most of the Marines stayed together there on Corregidor, and so they went over to Corregidor, but there was, I think, maybe some of the 3rd Battalion that was the separate battalion that ended up...
I believe it was a radar unit.
Right, and so they stayed, I think, doing some guard duty and didn't go to Corregidor.
They did make the march.
They did make the march.
Yes.
But most of the Marines weren't on the march.
No.
Because they were on Corregidor.
By the way, Susar, the dog, is with us all the time.
So tell us about, were you there when, and were you able to see when the Japanese destroyed what I'll refer to as MacArthur's Air Force there in
no.
Philippines?
Yes. That was, we had just... been in Mogadishu for 4 or 5 days, and then that morning the guys came around and said, the war has been. We already had a prior assignment to take a Navy barge down the coast to Mauritius. And so, even though it was an early reveille, they decided that in what's going on in the back, we're still going to make the trip on the Navy barge. So, as we were on the barge and going down the coast, grass slowly, the sailors on board were getting news about Pearl Harbor, and they heard how drastically it had happened. And directly some of those same sailors said, no, look ahead there, that island, that is the entrance to another bay, and that's Korea. And didn't think too much of it. Anyway, beautiful at a distance. About that time, we heard engines. This is the first thing. And we heard aircraft engines. And it's just almost instantly they appeared in sight. And there was, it turns out that it was the 36th plane armada that had just come from Clarkfield. And they were just lifting high on the way back to Formosa. Then I said, this is no drill.
So they were trying to get those planes out of there?
Oh, no, they destroyed them.
Oh, these are the Japanese planes you're talking about.
Yeah, 36, yeah, right.
36.
Japanese bombers, right. The American ships had been up in the morning, I understand. A few of them were around. They didn't come in for chow.
That's what I had heard too. They couldn't. They had to come in to refuel.
Yes, and they were all on the ground, perfectly lined up, ready to be demolished, and then they destroyed them. Then I believe it was the next day that they got to Kavili Point, and that was a bad scene too.
With Japanese bombers.
Yes.
And you guys end up going to Corregidor. And then the army falls back to Bataan, correct?
Yes.
And the mission of the fourth.
They had to destroy a bridge so shortly out of Manila
to break the advance of the Japanese, and they did get the job done, and they destroyed the Tarlac Bridge, I guess was the name of it, and they were then ensconced on a Boma Dam. And the Japanese finally got over it all, over that break, all right. And then the battle went on for, you know, 4 months.
And so Bataan fell...
April 6th.
What were you guys thinking over there on Corregidor when that happened?
It was a bad feeling, because those gun batteries in the distance firing were coming closer and closer and closer and closer. So, you know, down the line, man, there'll be some price to pay.
What was it like with MacArthur and Corregidor? Because I had heard that when you all first got there, you went into that nice barracks up in Middleside.
I could come in America Valence. Where did we go? They put us out in the jungle in some Nipa huts. And I said, well, I was out of town. And one day here comes the air raid siren again, and we figure it's us. And we look out the window, and no, they're going that way. And that takes them over Maravillas. And the Maravillas was a French ship that the American government had apprehended. And we had six Marines on there. Six. Anyway, two of them were killed.
And just a bomber came over and dropped its payload?
Three bombers.
And they just, and you guys were inside the barracks?
Inside Nipa huts.
Okay.
And it was 3 miles away. We could see the, with the window open, you could hear the rattle of the descending bombs. And if you were careful, when the sun was glistening, you'd see the bombs falling, and they destroyed that French ship, and it burned.
And so they destroyed that French ship and the barracks the same day?
And our dry dock. Well, there was no barracks there, no. The barracks had happened a week before.
Okay.
So they, after the barracks bombing, he said, boys, we're here, I mean business. And he said, the 3rd Battalion's going here, 2nd here, and 1st there. We drew Monkey Point, which was the end of the island. It was curved into the sea. You know, there's a high terrain and a natural place for the Japs to land. And so it was our luck to draw the 1st Battalion. And while we're getting set up there, MacArthur's house was out in our bivouac area.
What was the Marines' thoughts on MacArthur? Did they respect him?
Well, at that time, frankly, we kind of thought it was smart what he did on Bataan. He made some bad errors, and there's some lot of stories, and a lot of supplies got lost, people died, but that was still a good strategic move. And so he was a vanity stricken man, and he was stuck on himself. He was still a good general, as far as I'm concerned.
Tell me about working with the Filipinos and the nature of the regiment. The regiment at this point has grown, has it not?
Oh, yeah, we took on the time fell. There were oodles of guys swam that 3 miles of water to get to Korea.
That's a pretty long swim.
Yeah.
In ocean.
on bankers and pieces of wood, and there must have been a lot of guys lost that got swept out to sea. But a lot of guys made it. And they, what were they going to do with them? They put it in with Marines on beach defense. We didn't have more Springfields, but we did have, there'd been a barge load of Enfields, English, out there in the close in. So we distributed the Enfields to the oncomers. So the night of landing, there was
six of us Marines and eight sailors and Filipinos.
How were the
You're listening to an interview done by the commanding officer of the 4th Marine Regiment, Kevin Norton. And he's interviewing Warren Jorgensen, who's a survivor of, and you're going to hear about it, of, I believe, the Bataan Death March, unless he gets off the island with on a PT boat with Douglas MacArthur, and I don't think that happens, but I haven't heard the whole thing. But you've heard so far his life, what it was like in China, and then subsequent to that, the movement of the regiment from China to Ilongapo, and then in the Philippines, and then out to Corregidor, where the Navy had a fortress island, essentially, and a tunnel into a mountain. And that's where General MacArthur actually ultimately wound up. And so you can hear about that. So this is Warren Jorgensen, in his own words, interviewed by Colonel Kevin Norton, of at the time the CO of the 4th Marine Regiment.
Filipinos, as far as being...
All right. The Philippine scouts, by the way, were just fantastic.
When we talk about Corregidor, you talk about being on the beach and the situation had gotten to the point where you knew the invasion was coming. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what your... I've got to believe it's pretty tough on your mind when you're in a fighting hole, a foxhole on the beach, and you're just
That's
waiting.
That's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. A foxhole with one person in it is no good. You've got to be with buddies. I sat next to a foxhole and just thought everything. No good. Just not good.
So that's an important piece. Better to have two guys than one in a foxhole,
no
just
question,
for the
no
just
question.
For the psychological aspect to it.
Oh, and that's going to lead me to the last thing I want to say. Up until the day before the Jacks landed, as we guys are still calling each other names and telling stories and laughing it up till one day before the end.
Yeah. Well, that's an important part, is humor in any military organization,
yeah.
No matter how bad it gets. I had read that they had a lot of provisions, but they were rationing a lot of those provisions.
Yeah. I understand that in the tunnel they were still having meals. So the staff, of which must have consisted of a couple thousand, they were still doing all right, but they never saw the light of day. There were 4th Marines and the 59th and 60th Coast Artillery that were all out on the top. Most of our time is either bomb air raids or shelling, or early on there was a couple of air fights. And then there were whatever... things that we would decide to build, I just can't remember or come up with much other than digging the foxholes and the drops for the aerial bombs and then protecting your ass.
Tell me about the day the Japanese invaded Corregidor, and take me through that experience. You said you were in the foxhole by yourself, getting worried, nervous. I imagine everybody was thinking the same thing you were thinking.
I'm sure, yeah. The day started like any other day. The night was quiet, but the air raids started kicking off first thing in the morning. And they were bombing, and all the weaponry that had been captured, that the Japanese brought with them on Bataan, they now set up to fire on us. We were now within mortar range, and they had mountain mortars, and so they were fighting, firing mountain mortars,
and then the air raids. And it was a place, you know, smelled of whatever, Sacramento or whatever it is, and the noise was immense. And anyway, I'm sitting in my foxhole, and I can look out on the beach. And there, the Pacific Ocean was blue and pretty, and fish were jumping, and the whole other side of the world was right down there. And so, you, being in the London foxhole, it was murder. Until then, late in the afternoon, what really shocked me was the curtain and artillery piece on Korea, or on Bataan, the Japanese, was bracket firing. They were coming down the beach for landmines.
Trying to get the landmines.
Yeah, yeah. And, I got petrified there. It was disastrous. Anyway, it finally ended, and when the dark started to settle, a bunch of us were close to the galley. And, you know, well, maybe we could get some sea rations. So we ran over there, I guess, and see if we could find some chocolate. And while we were over there, which was a mistake, they started shelling again. And so the nearest safety is right over here is Monitum. And so we went and stood inside for a while, and directly a runner came in and with all the armies and the mix of army in there are wanted outside immediately. And so we went there, and there was, you know, a couple hundred of us. And we formed, had no officer, but an NCO, or two NCOs. And we made it just a semblance of a formation. And he said, we're going out to the beach. Boats have been heard, landing ships, landing craft has been heard on the beach. They're out in the bay, and then we're approaching Officers Beach, and we're going to go out and meet them. And so
you guys were heading back to the beach with this formation.
Yes.
And on the way to the beach, tell me what happened.
Well, we eventually come around, as we're approaching close to Denver Battery, and we run into a dead soldier who I recognize because we were close positioned with that. And we kept formation going on up this hill, and suddenly machine gun fire broke on us, and we all dove for the ditch. And I don't think any hand grenades, and I don't think any of the guys did. Anyway, we move around, the machine gun got us dead to ringer. That's when. Oh, the moonlight was shining. So moonlight night. Somebody says, B Company's coming. B was the weapons company. And Captain Castle was the skipper of that. And so they should never have said that. But several people are. Captain Castle does a machine gun ahead. And he come right on in under the street light. And right then the gunner got him cutting down right like that.
Japanese machine gun.
Yeah. And anyway, I got kind of blank. I remember we all ran out of that area and they said we're going to go on the north side, on the Tam side. So we went that side. And believe me, I cannot really remember a lot of what went on that night. But when I come to my senses in the morning, I realize that we're in a skirmish line or at the base of Vaughan Hill in Battery Denver, and apparently we're there to deter any drive of the jets on the left tunnel. And
there was a I was driving a pile of rubble, and there was a guy laying prone over here to my left, and grabbing something up over here. I can't remember. Maybe about 10, 12 feet. Oh, God, 20 feet apart. Anyway, down the line is this sergeant. I never found out what his name was or anything about it, but he was he'd been a boxer and had broken nose. And he had the courage to stand up there and keep firing, you bastards. He said, "We're going to knock those little sons out of there. Keep firing on that opponent." And he was sure of help. He took some of the fear out of it. And so anyway, I've got a whole clip of the bandolier of rifles, cartridges. And so I've been firing up there. I saw the guys zaps like trees. And I thought I had one. Anyway, the next thing I know, I had changed it and put a new clip in, and wow, I got hit in the side, and that knocked me over, and so anyway, to make a long story short, I thought I was a goner, and the guy next to me over there, he said, "That is a corner back in that building back where the remnants of a building, the foundation." And by that time, I just found out I could maybe move my legs a little bit. So I crawled 20, about 30 feet, and got in that entrance and in there. And sure enough, there was Corman all by himself. And he dressed my wound, and he said, "You got no business being out here, pal." He says, "You might as well head for the tunnel, because you're not going to be in your condition." So I legged it toward the tunnel and finally made it. Just before I get to the tunnel, we have a winding road and all the hulks of the brain cars that are left there from civilian days, from peacetime days. I come around the corner, and out between the two cars steps a sailor. And he's got a Colt in his hands, and he says, "Marine, can you help me?" And I'm kind of anxious to get into this, but I messed up, and I ejected the other bullet in the drive. So I ejected the
bullet. So it was jammed up.
Yeah, right. and asked him. I had took the time to ask him, "What the hell was he doing there by himself?" He said, "There's officers inside telling. They're assigning certain guys to go out and look for jazz."
Just for the pistol.
Look for jazz. Yeah. And so anyway, I then got back into my room and finally made it inside.
So can you tell us that story again about the two sergeants that went up with the hand grenades to Battery Denver and got on the water tower?
We were blocking any travel of the Japs toward Millennium Tunnel, so we were congregating around Watering Point. It's the high ground of the test. Control the high ground. And on top of this high ground, there's a water tower. Probably is bigger around than this room. And not too high, but 30, 40 feet. And there's a ladder on it. And these two friends, they were buddies, old timers, probably about ready to go back to the States. But you'd see them in the 4th Marine Club, and they were always buddying together. They decided that they would do something, so they got a sack of hand grenades and climbed that ladder on the top of the water tower and threw hand grenades down on the Japs. Until they were killed themselves.
We've got about 55 minutes, and I feel sick at my stomach. I am really low down. They are around now, smashing rifles. They bring in the wounded every minute. It is a horrible sight.
You're wounded in the tunnel, and I read that in your book, and then you end up on a working party after several days, and then you end up...
I was in the hospital for 6 weeks.
Right, in Malinta,
yes.
Right? And then eventually...
The main body of prisoners went off at the end of 2 weeks, but the rest of us, it was a matter of more serious than I thought. Anyway, I was still there in the 6th week. And one day, they said, your time has come. So he didn't look here. I left. And when we left, he said, you're going to go into a work detail on topside. And so two Japs in a truck pulled up, and they took us up to topside. There was 150 men in that detail on the topside, and we were picking up shrapnel and snow, everything going back to Japan. And one of the days of the... of a scrap iron detachment, probably 30 of us. The day had ended, we bundled the particularly sheet iron, you know, those thin stuff that you make garages out of. And bundled them. And the truck was loaded, and the guy who was the head honcho for the Japs had us line up, and he got up on a 50-gallon drum and he told his men to pass out cigarettes. He gave each of us a pack of Japanese cigarettes, and then he talked.
He was kind.
Yes, sir. He said he was sorry. That it was a good looking old gentleman. He was a Japanese Marine, probably 50. He was a good looking guy. And he kindly said, I'm just going to regret the circumstances in their own style of wordage. And he said, I only wish that you would drive home safely. God bless you. That's my enemy.
Yeah.
So that was one of a couple of acts of kindness that helped see.
What happened after that working party, and when you left Corregidor, where'd you end up?
Went to Clark Field. Just about the time that they were forming a detail to go to Clark Field and work on that runway. The Americans said Japanese had damaged the baddies. So 1,000 of us with a new captain, whose name I must look up, a great name. We were bussed. No, we went on our in 3 cars to Dow, a little town called Dow, by you'll know from the map. And that's true that we got out, and our assignment there was to dam a stream. And so we would rock and cement and rock and cement and made the dam for this. And then they had us work out on the airstrip. And see, that's at Clark Field. Since I was there a whole year, this was a ferrying point for the Japanese craft coming from Formosa. They go to Solomon, someone that way. And every once in a while, they'd have an action on the runway. And we would get a little excited, and they would then harass the hell out of us, beat us up, you know. Don't be so damn happy. I remember one day at noon, a flight was coming in, and it was a nasty, gusty, rainy day. And we saw the two planes come together and fall down in pieces, and we, I think, got excited. I don't remember. Anyway,
cured or something.
They weren't very nice. They beat us up a little bit.
What was the daily rations and food like? You mentioned that you were in a G-string. Rice and soup.
Yeah.
How much weight did you lose? Quite a bit.
Quite a bit. I was about 70 pounds. See, I was about 100 running about.
And what, you're normally about 170?
175.
And,
but you know what? I've never talked to anybody about this. But you look at the pictures, and I find some somewhere. One of them is a Hanawan. And here we are. This is when they found us, the aircraft, and we're up on the roof of the garage and things like that. And you look at that, and you say, those are skeletons. Those guys look pretty good. They're wearing hats and everything. We became a piece of iron. And I think we strengthened by the lousy diet and steady work and exercise. We were not the skeletons that they were as some of the other,
like in the Nazi camps and so forth.
Or even probably in Cabana. Nichols Field was horrible, and we lost a bunch of Marines to the Palawan.
Yeah, they were more like concentration camps almost.
Yes, they were barbed wire, and we never worked. And I looked up that skipper's thing for the army captain. And he took no shit from his Japs. They wanted workers. And so it turns out that with 1,000 of us and him above, they worked out their own details. We didn't have to bow. And something else we didn't have to do. However, we did have to learn to count in Japanese. And it was a daily deal. And you're going to make a deal, you're going to make a deal. That's the way to count in Japanese. And we worked 6 days a week, and so. But he was gutsy.
When you were at that Clark Field, were other members of the 4th Marines over there with you, or was it just a mixture of Army guys, Navy guys, and?
Yes. If I was to make a generalization, I would find out, reflecting back on history, most of the Marines stayed at Camp Cabana. And a lot of them went on that last boat, the boat after us. We were the last ones, hell ship, to get through.
Tell us about the hell ships. What are they, and why? And tell us what the.
They were standard. They were old freighters. They would been holds where they would have carried grain or coal or even horses, depending upon which one of them are. Our particular one, it had to have been coal, and in the holds down below, and so they crammed our whole 1,000 men from
Clark Field,
into that hole, and you see us sat with I had another buddy Marine with me, and we thought we were smart, and we got all of our stuff, and we're gone. Hang on to it because we don't know what it is. So I found a stanchion, an iron stanchion, in the hole, and we leaned against it. And he from one side and he from the other, because we had to then the people, his prisoners all landed between your legs. Didn't set up.
Like as many as they can pack in there.
Feed them into that. So if you had to go to the bathroom, which you never even did, it was enough. Indians would want to evacuate, but if you did, you had to wrench your way through to the a common latrine out there in the middle of the hole and do your thing and then fight your way back. And, I think I went once, so I'm fine on that six-day trip.
And did they feed you or give you any water?
Well, yeah. They would send down a tub on a rope. And then, yes, this is where the officers paid off. I wasn't on the one with Captain Beecher, or Colonel Beecher, but there were several Army officers in there, and they did and a chaplain. And they did a nice job of controlling the temperament in there, because there was fights and insane things happened, slashing, and guys lose their mind. But they did their very best
to keep the discipline up.
To keep the discipline,
right. But then,
where'd you go once the ship landed in mainland Japan? What was the name of the place?
We ended up Moji.
Moji?
Yeah. And we went through, apparently through a tunnel into, through Tokyo. And after we passed through Tokyo, they put us on a train. And the goal then was to drop off 50 here and 100 there and 50 there and release off of the prisoners. And in your cars that you were sitting in were all boarded shut, so you could, big people outside couldn't see us. And we got little rations of rice and there or anywhere on that trip, 3 days. We're going from the Tokyo Curve to Hanawa.
Hanawa.
Up north, part of the mountains.
I mean, what was your job up there?
I worked in a copper mine.
Copper mine?
Yeah.
What was the work like? What'd you do?
In my case, we would take in the morning, you'd get there, we get on a little electric train. And you go down maybe a mile or so, and they would to a drop-off point, and you just went down wooden ladders, three levels, I guess it was. So it's kind of warm down there, stinky and wet. So you work in this ladder. They had engineers would blast the rock. And then the prisoners would take the rock, they would put it in the wheelbarrow, and wheel it to an elevator, and you trip the elevator, and you would then drop the orb rock into the furnace, not below. And so I was in on one of those crews.
Good leaders that you had up there as far as the guys keeping the discipline for the workers?
Yeah, that same captain. I stayed with that captain. I was happy to be with him. And he had a couple of good lieutenants that stayed with him. We were, as far as Japanese were go, he probably occupied a little bit of a privilege. I don't know.
Your experience as a Marine, I mean, you went through some horrific things as you went from the height of Asiatic service in China to the low of captivity and Corregidor and the battle there, and you experienced most of World War II as a prisoner of war.
Yeah.
What would you tell a young man joining the service today, and the Marine Corps in particular?
I don't care what your real background is. I hope it's a good one. But if you pay attention to your DI and just keep your nose clean, and you're gonna be damn happy you was there. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. And so after I was wounded, and how lucky I am, I sort of became a little religious. I said, you know, God saved me. Maybe I should pay it back a little bit. So I don't know. Holy.
That's good. I think a lot of guys find religion in tough situations.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the guys, you know, when we had got over it, some of them haven't. They would never buy a Japanese car.
Can you give me some closing words on the importance of what we did in the Philippines and what we did in World War II for the Filipinos?
Well, to begin with, as I first come out to the Asiatics to stop at Manila, I wasn't really impressed, but it was apparently a good duty town for the guys at Cavite, and the Filipinos loved them. We learned that the galoot is a lousy egg to eat if you're American.
Galoot, yes. Yeah, I know. It's a chicken.
Yeah. God. And anyway, well, we really got some love from this, and we came down here during the war because in any action we ever had anything to do with them, we would have a few of them on Korea, unless we're on the mainland, until As a POW, we went on the mainland. There you found that the Japs would stick their neck out, or the Filipinos would stick their neck out for you, man. And then throw you food or bring some water, and they'd take all kinds of chances because they really could beat. And it's just so, they did their best to make it life good for us. They were grateful. They loved the Filipino scouts. They had done a lot, so they thought the regiment was real. And the fact that they would stick their neck out for you, like they did, it bonded us with them. They were just supremely wonderful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
How about that? That is awesome. Spending almost all of World, well, except for a couple months, all of World War II in Japanese labor camps. And you know what? Probably thanks his lucky stars that he got into the labor camps that he did, because other guys were not so fortunate. Anyway, we will take a quick break. Gunner's going to join us next here on a Thursday, so don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.